From Gustavus City Hall, and welcome to the work session for April 10, 2023. And we've got a big agenda for tonight, but we're going to start it off with an update on the PFAS contamination issue as things are developing here in Gustavus, and we're fortunate to have the two best informed people in Gustavus on PFAS here to give us an update on some of the stuff that's been happening. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what they've got to present. And Whitney sent out a great slide set that I hope you all find time to go through even after the meeting to make sure you're capturing all of that. There's a lot of detail and a lot of great information in it. So
you can't have it in landscape mode. That's getting better. No, that's the go up to. You gotta go. Wait, do you want to put the chair over there and you can drive from there? I'm good. Okay. When we get there. So now we have it ready.
Okay. So I think this is a older map, 2021. And so that means the data is even older than that. And I know Whitney's got updated maps and data that you'll see later. But this gives a rough idea of the initial scope of the problem of PFAS in Gustavus. The council's heard a lot in bits and pieces over the years from us. And I think some council members are better informed than others on what PFAS is and why it's a problem, but I'm just gonna go like quick bullet points and I'll have you pull a couple things up. So why is PFAS a problem? It's extremely toxic at extremely low levels. It's one of the most thoroughly researched toxin, although it doesn't get pressed for that as much as it should. And the powers that be, like the Chemical Council, are very interested in pushing that data down so you don't get to see it. Every time I testified at the House and the Senate, the Chemical Council called in from Washington, D.C. and also testified. So c8sciencepanel.org, if you can go there. Just so you guys can see it once, they did the first huge cohort when C8, when PFAS was discovered, when it was just still PFOS and PFOA, mostly PFOS in, where was it? The Devil We Know, do you remember?
Oh.
In the South. Yeah, the DuPont plant.
Virginia, I think North it's Carolina, South Carolina, one of those.
But yeah, so part of their settlement when they settled with DuPont was to do an enormous human study, and they were able to link diseases. So for six disease categories, the science panel concluded that there was a probable link to C8 exposure. So they're still calling this C8 as PFOA. And those six diseases were high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, thyroid disease, testicular cancer, kidney cancer, and pregnancy-induced hypertension. If anybody hasn't watched The Devil We Know, it's a blockbuster film, it's a good watch, and it's very informative and you should watch it. And I emailed the library to see if they have it, because I am not sure if they do or not. But if they don't, then they will be getting it. So our journey in Gustavus was similar in the fact that we kind of had to prove things out for ourselves here, I think. So we got the initial information from DOT, I guess, when we all got the letter in our mailbox in 2018. And from there, the plume was not well defined. It took a lot of hit and miss to figure out where things were. It took a lot of proactive residents to figure out where things were. And my approach was like, the more data, the better. let's search everywhere and search everything. And we did everywhere and everything we could. If you can go, Kyle, to our website, gpacalaska.org, I believe. And if you guys aren't familiar with this, I just want the image in your mind and the website. And this houses all of our information. So it's a beautiful website that Sean and Janet built for us. And we have on there, on one of those, what we do probably. The report that I believe the city has also that the McDowell Group did for us, that contains all of the information with about testing wild game, so moose and bear. We tested chickens, chicken eggs. Lots of garden produce was tested. So the problem is not confined to water. And that was one thing that we wanted to prove, that we were not going to get proved with the state testing. That the soil is also a huge problem, and anything you grow in the soil becomes contaminated. And then that contamination goes up the food chain. So the moose and the bear that are eating the same things, or not eating the same things, that are living in the same area, eating different things. The bear is at the top of the food chain, ingesting more animals that have ingested more PFAS contaminated things, so that those numbers are higher in bears. And we're the highest on this food chain, so our numbers are the highest. So that sort of led to this idea of testing our blood, because that hadn't been done anywhere. And the Chemical Council, again, was very opposed to that or using that information for anything, because there's not enough data on blood tests to correlate health effects. So you have to create the data in the blood, with the blood, to correlate the health effects. So that was the study that we did in Gustavus, was the first of its kind. I think it's still the only one. And there is a positive correlation between water consumption and blood level, which may seem like a no-brainer, but now it's on paper. So you drink contaminated water, your blood PFAS levels go up. That's exaggerated for children, because their intake of food and water is proportionally much greater than ours. So an infant, and additionally, they're crawling around on PFAS contaminated carpets, but their exposure is far greater than ours. For example, when I had my blood tested, my son's was twice mine. We moved back to Gustavus at the same time I was pregnant with him here. So we should have had equal exposure, but his was twice mine. I'd never had my daughter tested. So the kids are at huge risk for it. The next step after having that blood test done, and that was 10% of Gustavus, we had 40 participants. So depending on which population number you choose to go off of, I call it 10% of Gustavus. So it's a pretty good representation of Gustavus. So the next move from there was a gal named Rochelle. And if can you go to the what we do and see if these are there? I'm not sure where they are housed under. Blood tests is there. History accomplishments. So the McDowell report should be under the history accomplishments. I don't think Rochelle Nottingham's paper is on the website, but I'll make sure that it's on our Google Drive. So the McDowell report's really good. It goes through all of the things that we did up to that date, 2021. Rochelle Nottingham, who became a DEC employee, and I'm not sure if she still is. I haven't been in touch with her for a little while. She took our blood tests and correlated them with negative health outcomes in Gustavus. So, and she did this all blind, but if you have, the higher your PFAS level is, the higher likelihood of a negative health outcome there is. So it's just putting the steps in place to prove what we already know. But Gustavus was really on the cutting edge of that. And I think that because we were so proactive, we got a lot of attention here. So we got a lot more than I think we would have here otherwise. So all of that to say, that was kind of our journey. Please go through and look through the website to familiarize yourself with what's been done. The most, I commonly get questions that could be answered by looking through the data that's already been presented. Yeah, can you look, can you go to the Google Drive?
Yeah, go back to the homepage. PFAS resources.
Yeah. And our mission statement too, I want to pull up. Should be on there somewhere. Yeah, before we leave, let's go. Maybe it's under, yeah, there you go. Okay, so our goal with all of that for why PFAS matters or why PFAS is a problem, our goal was to stop further use. And we mostly did that. The airport still houses PFAS foam. They promise not to use it. If Senator Keel's bill passes, that PFAS foam should leave and we should be able to operate with sodium bicarbonate or fluorine-free foam whenever the FAA deems that appropriate. Our second goal was to create public understanding of the full extent of the damage. That's definitely ongoing. I feel like for the DOT plume, that's been pretty well established. I think that the other four or five hot spots need to be better defined. And I think there's a lot more room for public awareness. I think people mostly think if they don't live near the airport, they're fine. And with the lowering of the levels nationally, I think more people than know it are affected. And then our third goal was to facilitate the correction of the PFAS damage to the fullest extent possible. So we worked to get cisterns, and that those are going up all over town, and that's the water solution, which is great, but the soil is still contaminated. Eventually, maybe if the pole is not there, there will be less drifting from the airport, but ideally we get something to arrest the plume, like Plume Stop. And there's a company called Aquaga that does a pump and treat, and the concentration at the DOT well, which is the hot spot, is high enough that their pump and treat method would be effective here. So I'm really, really hopeful for Plume Stop. I think that the initial work that GPAC did to prove that it could be effective here was a boost in the right direction for DOT. And I believe, I need to follow up with Kristen Freiberger, but I believe they're going to be here this summer to assess where they would put it and what other testing needs to be done. So still a little bit of a ways out, but I think for me, that would feel like a job done for the DOT plume. And I would feel really good about that. So those were our main goals, and I feel like those are the basic goals that anybody working with this should have or would have. Our, yeah, please.
You said that the systems were put in.
So yes and no. There's the Gustavus End got a major filtration system. It pulls most of the longer chain ones, but the smaller chains slip through. The longer chain PFAS sit in the ground, the shorter they get. So they break up. and turn into smaller chains and go further and slip through more things. So mostly for our situation, like a GAC, colloidal activated, granular activated carbon would work, but not as well as a pure source. The only when I can't remember if it was DEC or DOT did the testing, but there was a Berkey filter tested that removed everything. So that's what I bought for the gallery, and I'm even gonna buy one for my house, I think, even though I have the rainwater sister. I love it.
It's
one
it's
a countertop. It's got giant charcoal filter. Yeah, the library has one. Yep. And reverse osmosis works, but it extracts everything and then dumps that extracted concentrated contaminant into your system, which in somewhere else might work, but in Gustavus, it's like dumping it into somebody else's water. Takes it out, isolates it, dumps it into your septic. Yeah. So then if there's a pumping of the septic and they go dump it somewhere, and you know, nobody knows that that's been dumped in their yard.
And the filters have been had.
You're right. And we don't have a good way to get rid of those. So solutions and goals, in my mind, the simplest is clean water and clean air. That's the goal. In order to clean up, we have to identify the source of the problem. So the airport, and you'll see when Whitney puts up her maps, how many samples have been taken. And I think she didn't even get them all on there. But it takes a lot of information to identify the source before you can even clean up. So for the city working with these like sporadic sprayings or whatever, I don't know what to call them. I think that there needs to be a lot more testing in those areas, wells of different depths. If you want to identify where the source of those areas are, the sources in those areas are, and clean them up, I think there's a lot of testing that needs to go into that. I would suggest that the city put some intention towards some position, and whatever you guys would like to do with it, but I think it's a bigger job. I know it's a bigger job than any one of you can do, and it's not something you can all do collectively. You would all be working 40 hours a week on it together and trying to, the learning curve is steep. I think that if you could ideally like do the best thing, you would hire somebody as an independent contractor so they are beholden to the people and not the city's bottom line, and have that person advocate for clean water for Gustavus, working with the city, working with the state, working federally, but most of all working with organizations like ACAT, and specifically ACAT, because they have the expertise and the history and the connections. And ACAT is really the only reason that GPAC was able to be as successful as we were, because whenever we were at a hurdle, I would call Pam and be like, okay, what do we do now? What's the next step in this? And you know, she's got so many connections and so much knowledge. Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and Pam Miller is their chair, and she also is the chair of IPEN, which is the International Pollutants Something Network. Yeah, she's got like a GPAC kind of thing for the Arctic. Yeah. So ideally, that's what I would recommend. And like minimally, I would suggest that Pam either come to Gustavus and sit with you guys as a council, or call in and do like a 2-hour, what should we do next planning kind of session. In one of our grants that we got from the city, we had funds for a second summit. The funds were paid to Annie Mae. They're still sitting there holding a spot for eventual second summit. So there could be worked into some sort of something that could benefit the community. There could be a community-wide presentation, time for the city to ask questions, make a plan, something like that. And in the meantime, I think the city's responsibility is at very least to be an advocate for clean water for the community. So to be on the phone writing letters whenever possible about any legislation going on anywhere, because it will all further our agenda. And I don't know, this might be out of the scope of what you could do, but something like a Berkey for everybody. I don't know. I mean, they're not horribly expensive and they're effective. So if someone's concerned about their drinking water, maybe the city can help.
So when you say that, what's it
called? I was just looking at them today. They're about $400 for the small ones. Yeah, well, there's a damaged one, like a blemished Berkey's. That's where I got mine. One other thing, what was that? The Google Drive. Yeah. The Google Drive was just a data dump, basically. click on the Google Drive thing. So it's the history of what we did. Media and letters are good resources. Just kind of what we went through, what we asked for, they could be used as form letters, you know, cut and paste what's important right now. The iPen reports are old, but that's why fluorine-free foams are effective. They've been used around the world for years. They've been used at oil refineries. They've been used at major airports, but the United States still says that they're not safe. They're not effective. And yeah, so I would, if you have a minute to peruse sometime, there's a lot of information there. Also, at the library, there are two binders full of PFAS-related studies that are years old now, but still good information. And I know there's a binder here, but I don't know how well kept it is. What is all in there? But this is a good source for condensed information. Any questions? Yeah.
A million, but they're probably in resources.
Okay. Yeah, the McDowell report is a full, like, beginning to end accomplishments thing. That's a good one. Mm-hmm.
All right. We'll switch to the PowerPoint. I'll go.
Excellent. Okay, so I see that we might get some cropping off, but you guys all got the PDF too, and the PowerPoint is also now on at least Kyle's computer. So essentially, this was the last drinking water map the state produced for us. And so if this is kind of the map that's ingrained in your head, stay tuned. Hopefully by the end of the conversation, you'll have realized that a lot of things have happened since 2021. And I definitely think that Kelly hit on it as well. There's definitely a not in my backyard. And NIMBY thought that this is only an issue around the airport and it's not in my backyard. Why should I care? And if you don't know me, I'm Whitney Rapp. I do not live or work in this area. However, I'm committed to our entire community, which is why I've invested a lot of time trying to pull this data together. And so let's go to the next slide. So we went from the well testing, the drinking water testing, where we were getting those maps, to a site characterization. So the first Site characterization report was in 2019. There was a 2021 one. They skipped 2020 because of the pandemic. The next one, it usually takes over a year before we see them through reviews and stuff. So we are lagging always in data. Data is now scattered over at least 5 locations, and I listed them here. I was in contact with DEC today because I'm missing a whole bunch of data still, and they kept sending me through the hamster wheel of looking at all the sites. I'm like, I got it. I know where to go look. You don't have that data. And they sent me some of the private well data. I'm like, no, I'm looking for the ones that start with MW, not PW. So I know that they know who I am at this point. If anyone else has been hunting for the data, let's collaborate. But I'm guessing I am probably the only one that's as eagerly searching their websites, probably in the state, maybe. So why do I think amount of public communication dropped? First off, we had the pandemic. I think that definitely affected things. They liked in-person meetings. But they've also had huge turnover in staffing. We are now on to at least the 4th, if not the 5th point of contact. And that person's actually out on maternity leave, as I learned trying to track down this data. So we've lost that continuity of the person that started is not even the last person. It's now like the 5th person before us. It's definitely not easy to find the data. So if you don't feel like you're on top of it, you are not the only one. All right, let's go to the next one. Yep, no worries. Okay, so I'm just giving a print screen. You don't expect to be able to read this, but this is kind of a sense of what some of these documents look like. They're all PDFs. They have awful tables that you really can't extract things because they're a PDF. They give you small maps, but there's definitely no real analysis or trends. So you have to hunt through all the, you know, they do give you some coloration in the maps, but then you have to hunt back through the tables and start trying to do mental games. This is no way to try to analyze a situation, which is why you have me, who loves data. So next one. All right, so there's a number of different samples that have been taken in the Gustavus area. So I'll first off say there are a huge number of more samples in the airport compound from the airport repaving and the ditch work. I just didn't get a chance to synthesize those and just moved on because we're not living inside the airport fence. So right now, they've tested 147 unique wells in the Gustavus area. Let's go on to the next one. And I'll just say, I definitely applaud the state for taking, with the contractors they've hired, to do as rigorous a sampling as they've done. You know, they've integrated comments from people like Kelly and I to expand the search or know how water is moving. And I'm also going to just point out that these are real people. These are real people's properties. And I will be vague in what I know. And I know everyone is going to home in on where they live or who they know in those areas. But please be sensitive to that because no one asked for this. Okay, so monitoring wells. So after they moved past identifying the private wells, they started drilling monitoring wells that they can resample. Now at a quarterly basis. So there's 59 of those in the Gustavus area. And you'll notice that the airport project has a widely distributed network of monitoring wells. And then there is an entire cluster around a different plume. So you can definitely see the density difference in monitoring wells. All right, so then go on to the next one, please. Right. And in many of the monitoring wells, they are a pair with a shallower and a deeper one. So not only do we have a spatial and a temporal, but we also have a vertical monitoring approach. Although at this density, it's not easy to make huge inferences. Okay, so we got past the monitoring wells and now we're onto the temporary well points. So these ones were put in for the airport project. I'm guessing they do, it's kind of like a sand point. They get one sample and they abandon it. They've never been resampled. So I think this was a quick and dirty way to get a more data. And because I was mostly focused on water for this, I used those as well. So there's 23 of those that have been done. Next one, please. Over time, at least 51 surface water samples. There was a bunch more inside the airport, so I didn't capture all those. But you can see those are distributed in many of our ditches and ponds. And many of them have elevated, significantly elevated. So when your dog is eagerly getting a drink of water, please consider that.
Including the river at 5 parts per trillion, which when we first tested, I was like, 5 parts per trillion, one at 70, it's probably fine. Now the limit is like, 1,000 times? Suggested 1,000 times less than 5 parts per trillion.
Okay, and so then to the next one. So these are soil borings. So while they were drilling the monitoring wells, or they actually drilled some other holes, they took soil samples at different depths to get an idea of how much had migrated down into the soil column. So those are all available. Those are a one-time snapshot as they're drilling. So those don't get re-sampled. On to the next one. And then there's been 130 surface samples. So that's just a snatch from the surface to give an idea of how much is in the surface layers. And most of that has been inside the plumes. So it doesn't give us a good sense of what's happening on people's properties or on our roads. Next one, please. Okay, so there are now over 500 sample sites with over 1,000 analyzed results. So don't get me wrong, the state has done heroic in getting this data together. The data become publicly available often more than a year delayed. And I am often making repeat requests and having them denied until they, I think, finally break down and give me the data. The three plumes have different data sets. And if you're unaware, we likely have at least three plumes. I've put dashed lines around them because they really do not have boundaries, but I was just trying to contain where they've sampled for these three areas. I would definitely suspect that there has been disposal in other areas too, but it's not as pronounced as at least these three locations.
The Howell report that the city has somewhere too goes into the releases that way predated our knowledge of this.
Yeah, and if anyone in Gustavus was aware of PFAS before 2018, kudos to them.
Yeah.
So all three of the plumes have samples that are in what I call the notorious 10. So whether it's the top 10 of all the different sample sites. So regrettably, we can't just focus on one of them. We really need to look holistically at the whole area. And if you notice, all of those interlapped. So they will intermingle and, you know, fingers cannot be put in any one direction. Next up, please. So I guess the big thing is, so what? Why, you know, we had that original map, how does this all play out? So when we first started with the state in 2018, we were doing a sum of 5, and it was the sum of PFAS, PFOA, PFHXS, PFHPA, PFNA. And if you think I even have these straight at this point, I don't. So it was a sum to 65. Then by the spring of 2019, they relaxed the standards to the sum of only PFAS and PFOA to 70. They grandfathered people in who got tested on that first round, but did not honor that for those tested after that date. Then last year, the EPA is currently undergoing their PFAS strategic roadmap, EPA's contamination commitments to action 2021 to 2024. So last year they set non-enforceable advisory health limits of 0.02 parts per trillion and 0.04 parts per trillion for PFOA and PFAS. You don't realize that is considerably, those orders of magnitude less than what we're doing. And in that roadmap, they said by the fall of 2023, they'd be issuing more regulatory information. And I'm just going to highlight right now that they're talking public water supplies. And I'll come back to why that could be a big problem. So let's go on to the next one. All right, so 3 weeks ago, EPA released their proposed rule. So it's in a proposed rule right now. It's open for comment. It very likely could change. Even when published as a rule, it could be litigated. I'm not suggesting this is anything that's like hard and fast right now. And this is the first time the EPA has taken national action at this level for decades. So it's fairly precedent setting. So I don't really know what it means for the future. But their so right now, their first column is their goals. And that second column is the enforceable levels for public water supplies. So for PFOA, their goal is zero, and the enforceable limit will be 4 parts per trillion. PFAS, 0, 4 parts per trillion. And then the next 4 compounds will be a hazard index. So it will be the value divided by their risk level. So if let's just pick PFHXS. And I highlighted that one because we have a lot of that in the community. If they decide that 20 parts per trillion is the index level and you have a well of 30, you're going to be over that index level of 1. If it was 10 and we still have, you know, a 20 is the index, you're at 0.5 and maybe you're going to make it up with the other 3, but you might not. Right. So it's a sum of those 4 divided by a normalizing value for each of those chemicals. I couldn't find those normalizing values. So So regardless, I'd already calculated the sum of 5 from the first round, and 4 of those 5 are the same. And we really don't have PFNA, HFPODA, and we don't really have PFHPA. So I'm just explaining why I used the sum of 5 because I had it and I had already spent a lot of effort. So we're just going to go on with as an index, because why I'm saying that is even though PFOA and PFAS at 4 are already super low, there are some wells in town that won't be tripped by those two, but I'm pretty sure PFHXS will get tripped in the hazard index.
It's shorter
and it seems to be moving faster. So it's kind of the leading front on some of these plumes. So when we've only focused on the first two, we're missing kind of part of the story that's out and out ahead. All right.
In a way, we're lucky that we had all legacy foam products used here because they are longer chains, so they stay still a little bit more. If we were dealing with Gen X, this entire place would be covered with it, and it's harder to capture.
Yeah, ready. So what? Will it apply to private wells? At this point, I'm skeptical it will. And then what? What will the state of Alaska do to respond to that? Will they also drop down to those same levels and honor it? Or are we all going to kind of be screwed and have to deal with it like we deal with arsenic and iron and sulfur and everything else and all have to deal with it our own? That's going to be really a regrettable situation since no one asked for this and this was definitely a contaminant. It will open up CERCLA funding, which is what we call Superfund. And so having that as a pot of money could be lucrative if we have the effort to write grants and get that here. That's going to be a lot of lobbying. EPA is proposing wastewater discharge. So if we do either find a solution here or move it to Juneau, the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System limits may make it not lucrative for us to dispose of our septic because it will be contaminated. And you're probably guessing that I might actually know how this is going to affect the map of Gustavus. Well, yeah. So comments are due by May 30th to the EPA, and I recommend individuals and the community to kind of figure out what it is that each of us needs, because this has widespread effects for both residents and businesses in the core of our town. So, next slide. All right, so I took all of the water samples. I took away the soil samples. They're relevant, but I just focused on water. I didn't focus on how deep the ones they were or anything. And I used the sum of five because I knew PFHXS particularly needed to be part of the story. And I took the maximum value of sum of five that we've seen, and basically statistically ran an interpolation between all those points, and you get a first draft that sometimes throws anomalous things out around the edges just because it's too far away, like way down in the De Beer subdivision or otherwise. So then that basically just tells you how I created it, all the points that were used, you can kind of get an idea. So if Kyle, if you go to the next one, I then clipped that to be a more realistic. Those ones that were on the outskirts, particularly if they were non-detects, I definitely clipped the data so that they didn't just run off to average way out to nowhere. And so this basically is showing that anywhere that there's a color, there's a pretty high probability that there's detectable PFAS. And if the EPA goal is zero, all of these people stand a reasonable chance of having PFAS water, and anything from blue to red are probably going to exceed that EPA proposed level at this point. So that's, you know, a pretty significant amount of the community, and you can see that there's different patches. A lot of this is dependent on how many wells and how many water samples there are. But there are different patches out there. Yep, so yeah. It does, but right. So you have the shallower and the deeper well, as well as your water here. So all of those three spots are really close together. And so the interpolation right there diminishes that. Well, all three of those are really just about co-located. So when it does the merging there, it's coming up with a value in the 300s. So you've got, yeah, on the shell. Correct. So fair enough. Okay, so moving onward. Okay, so then I'll talk through to the next one. So then I superimposed our drinking water and our monitoring wells onto this map. The darkest red shade are the ones that the state has already acknowledged exceeded the current Alaska levels. And so there's 23 of those wells at least, with the proposed EPA based on just the PFOA and the PFOS, there will be a 21 additional wells that will exceed that threshold. There are 51 that have had detectable amounts of PFAS, and I suspect several of those will bump up into that exceed level because of PFHXS. And then fortunately, 49 of those wells have never had a detect, but most of them have only been sampled once. And honestly, the vast majority of people at the lower end have only been sampled once. So there are some people that are in the monitoring program that are getting quarterly or annual monitoring, but most people dropped out of that and have only been sampled once. I hope at this point you start seeing that this is a much broader issue than just the airport. And many residents and businesses are affected by these proposed changes in regulation let alone just the health implications that are connected with it. So if you continue on. All right, so I buffered each of those wells by 100 yards, and 100 yards is about the distance from here to the house across the river, just to give you a sense. I felt like I looked at a bunch of like spacing of our houses, and 100 yards seems like a reasonable buffer. And so anywhere that's not orange has sampling within 100 yards. Anywhere that's orange has never had public data associated with it. People may have tested, but I don't have that data to incorporate. So there's still, and then all those yellow fireflies are buildings that I presume have a water source, and no public test data has been taken from them. That might be by choice, that might be because there's definitely people in this group that have advocated to get it tested by the state and have been denied that and told to test on their own. So particularly when there is a detection on the margins of this plume, I think that's, you know, maybe there's no more houses and we don't need to worry, but there is definitely detections on the margin that have residents around them that have never been tested. So I think that's definitely one thing to consider, is that we have not fully characterized the margins of our triple plume. And that could be something that the state or the city could advocate for or help support. You continue on. So this next one is basically showing the lighter color is all of the more private lands in Gustavus and city lands. And you can see this really does affect a significant amount of the private lands in Gustavus. But the other thing is there's been no testing outside of this core area. And like Kelly said, you know, the Howell report did quantify or did enumerate other fire responses in the community that might have had foam because we didn't know any better, or we did mass casualty drills that had foam, or any number of other things. So just thinking that this is restricted to the airport area is also simplistic at this point. So on to the next one. So I've been showing mostly spatial trends just to kind of, you know, figure it out that this is not restricted to the airport, but there's also starting to be temporal trends that are being identified. So this is the shallower monitoring well right outside of City Hall here. This is actually, these pair of wells are the only two wells that we have the full data set for. That's how I figured out we were missing seven data points for all the other wells. So the well came back very low in October 2019, and by the next sampling in the fall of 2020, it had spiked. So the sum of PFO and PFOS was around 300. It's had a max of 588. Summer seemed to be when it's highest. Winters are when it's lowest. That's 2 years of data to kind of show those trends. Perhaps it'll play out that way. Perhaps it'll do something else. I'm not going to even speculate why that happened or otherwise, but I've known about it since I saw the data back in 2020. And then I could see on the DEC website that they then did more sampling in the area around here. And it took me months for them to release the data from that, but they wouldn't tell me where the data was. So I got the 23 wells and the results, but no idea where they were. And so then it took me another 4 months of, you know, like, okay, well, I know there's, you know, these wells I know are already contaminated. So you're not really, you know, proving anything by withholding this. So they finally conceded and gave it. So you've been seeing that data, but that's just the level of effort sometimes you need to go to get this data. And I'm not even going to guess why, but it's.
The missing data points on monitoring wells.
Yeah, so we only have four of those 11 sampling dates for the whole network of airport wells.
They released they're releasing annually now. So they released 2021 at the beginning of 22. So we should have just had.
So just the 20.
They're way delayed and only doing it annually, which is another place I think that the city could help it get more direct.
Yeah, because I've had the guy, I've seen the guy out here 2 different times.
They'll send you your own results immediately after testing, but not the compiled data.
Well, these are monitored, so they're not yours.
Oh, yeah.
And so most of the reason I was trying to get the well data for this area was a renter who was concerned, and they're not going to get the results because they're the renter, they're not the owner. You can just see where this, you know, trickles down. Okay, so then, and I'll just also say that the deeper well here is not showing this spike. So this is something that's more superficial of these two wells. And I wish I could say that's been happening in all the wells, but I did not look at the temporal trends because I really don't even have the data or the time right now. So another level of analysis that can be done with the data. One. Okay, so I'm going to be the first to say the city is never going to fix this problem on its own. So, you know, that is not the request that I'm making of you guys, but like Kelly, I definitely need a unified voice to advocate for improvements that will have small to large benefits over a variable duration of right now to generations. I'm not going to read our whole vision statement, but we have elements in all four points that touch on this topic, so you can revisit it in your PDF. So continuing on to the next one. So some of my actionable ideas for the council would be to really start looking into a municipal drinking water with treatment and distribution. I'm not saying that has to be pipes, it could be truck to tanks or something, but the extent of our problem just got a lot bigger, and it's not like we have perfect water regardless between arsenic and iron and sulfur and septic interactions. If we continue to grow at the rate we are, I would also say that it was really illuminating to me on this 2021 site characterization, how many of the deeper wells hit salt water. So that really confirmed to me that going deeper is not a solution. It's always been rumored that you can't go deeper, but they hit salt water on so many of them, you know, we don't have a deeper water supply. Wastewater treatment options need to acknowledge they will have PFAS. And so if we're doing it locally or if we're exporting it, it becomes a contaminated source that could make it less desirable. I would say we need to be advocates for private wells getting protections equal to public water supplies. We have no alternative. If you look on the DEC website and the DOT, you know, the number of reports for Gustavus is a lot larger than all the other communities. I'm not saying we have the worst problem because I did not analyze everyone else's data, but I think the problem is greatest here because we have no municipal water supply. We have all private wells. And so we have more affected people.
More aware people, I mean.
Probably. I came from King Salmon and they also have contamination, but they have confined aquifers and they have some municipal water. So almost everyone has a solution available to them where we don't. So having the city have a seat at the table during decisions related to work plans for sampling and remediation, it really took a lot of effort for Kelly and I, particularly during the airport repaving, to acknowledge that, I mean, at first there was not even a thought that asphalt could have contamination, and then we learned asphalt was highly contaminated. So, you know, it was always being behind the eight ball and learning about things, we need to be out in front and part of those planning efforts. This is from my perspective, the data available in tabular format soon after available from labs. I could definitely tell that Bill had it all in a database today because it's like, I see it all in the database. I'm like, yeah, can you just share that database? So that would make my work a lot easier because rather than hunting and then trying to decode a PDF back into a table. Encourage the removal of the contaminated soil stockpiled at the southeast end of the runway. So that big pile with the white cover, that's all contaminated materials from the airport. It's supposed to be temporary. So fortunately, there's no down gradient water supplies, but it's still stuck in our community. Be part of the planning for remediation. Have the data from the three plumes be considered as a whole. Right now, they're in three different data sets. I think Shannon and Wilson is now probably the primary on all three of them. It didn't necessarily start that way. So each of them reports differently. But you know, they are all intermingled in some capacity. I think ditch, road, and airport work all needs advance notice for PFAS considerations. Any movements of soils from within the affected area to outside creates potential new plumes. So we saw all the quote unquote non-contaminated asphalt being called off by local people at the end of the airport project to be used in road bases and driveways, you know, so that's now, it's probably all low level, but it's now, I don't even know where it is. It's in the community.
I was pretty well convinced that was the gym. It was like okay. The leftover from their
batch plant.
Yeah.
But they were reprocessed.
I don't remember the details, but I remember being like, oh,
all right.
But they did, but they were reworking the old asphalt through the plant.
Yeah.
And if PFAS compounds aren't destroyed by those temperatures, which I wouldn't think they would be,
no,
they could still be in there.
Somehow not, somehow asphalt that had not been used.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
And then not an asphalt.
Yeah.
We'll hope so.
Ask Elma.
But, you know, soils from inside there may be below, the threshold for soil is much higher as it should be. We're not usually eating soil, but if we're taking, so like when they do the ditch work, I've been encouraging them to ditch coming into the airport rather than ditch going out, and that hasn't always happened. So at least you're trying to keep it within the confines of the ditching. And then advocate for testing the peripheral wells to ensure we know the current envelope of the plumes. And I would say also test around near the other proposed or other places where firefighting happened that might have a signature. So that's, and you can go on to the last slide, is kind of my disclaimer on the data. Basically, I had to reverse engineer this all. So I know there's got to be some mistakes in there. And I'm sorry, if you have concerns or questions, I will happily out there in the community go validate those data sources, because there's 500 sites, 1,000 samples, and inevitably I probably gave something. So, thoughts?
Yeah, very great.
The Patricks are working on some kind of water system. It will be something that matches the quality of the cistern water so that it can be replenished when we go through a low rain period. And I am assuming they will sell that to whoever or make it available. So maybe a conversation with them about that process, and it's through Shannon and Wilson.
So now is that, are they treating well water or is it just rain catchment?
I think both. And when I've talked to Shannon and Wilson about it, I've been guaranteed every time that it will be the same quality as the rainwater so that there won't be any weird interplay where things grow that shouldn't.
I would imagine he'll have to be a DEC approved public water supply. So we do already have some public water supplies in the community that get DEC mm-hmm. level scrutiny.
Right.
So they would just need to follow through with that too.
Yeah. And they're working with DOT for sure. So I'm certain DEC's got to be involved already.
I've got a question. How actively is DEC working on these things and who is the point of contact?
Like Whitney was saying, it's changed several times. They lost so many people and yeah, just super high changeover. And
They're not really working it.
Not a lot of encouragement to work on the problem is my impression. But I think that's where I don't feel like I'm able to offer you guys a lot of advice, because all of my contacts have been through DOT, who is so obviously the responsible party and a willing responsible party. So whatever the city does, you guys being the responsible party, because you had no idea, DEC is involved in guiding you, but there's money restriction in it. So, I mean, I don't know what you guys are up against with that. But I would imagine that as much pushing as you can do using our representatives and just flooding DEC with phone calls is probably going to help.
At this point, Bill O'Connell is up high.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's probably instructed his subordinates to defer all questions from me to him. So I would start just with him.
Start with Bill O'Connell.
Okay. Yeah.
And where? And he's in Juneau or
Fairbanks?
Or
I have no idea.
Fairbanks.
Okay, we can find him.
And I think all three plumes that are listed on the DEC site are now under an Alyssa. I've never spoken with her, and she's on maternity leave. So then I went to her direct supervisor, who didn't even, I keep CCing her just to keep her in the loop. But Bill has been responding again. So,
and can I add something to that? So, because of my contact with Sarah Thomas, so this session's bill is a watered down version of last session's bill.
Watered down is generous.
Sorry. This session's bill is a watered down version of last session's bill, which didn't pass.
Did it actually get a vote?
I don't know. It might have passed out of committee, but I don't know that it's had a full vote.
62, I think. So, SB 62.
What?
It's SB 62, I think.
I don't know what the bill number is right now, but what I was leading to on this is that Sarah's group, the ERTIC group, ACAT, has advanced a list of 6 or 7 more things to essentially putting back in the bill the things that were in it last year, which included medical testing, like advocating for medical testing, because right now insurance companies don't consider it a medical test. They consider it an environmental test and they don't cover it. They don't even have a CPT-4 code for it yet, apparently. So I called Senator Keel's office and I haven't got a response yet, because I said, what is your tactic for this? Like, what is your... Are you trying to just get this and then get amendments, or are you going to try to move some of these things through and add them to the bill? Or like, so we can advocate on the city's behalf for the passage of the bill, but do we also want to say, and we want you to add these things to it? So that's the fine line, and I'm waiting to hear back from them on what their approach to the whole thing is and how we should maybe respond for testimony and or support, basically.
I think supporting the bill is good. It takes, as soon as the FAA releases airports from PFAS-containing foam, it mandates every airport in the state of Alaska to remove PFAS-containing foam. So it's a huge step, but I mean, Keel, to his credit, started with everything we asked for. I mean, we sat down at the table at the gallery and built that bill with like everything we wanted in it. And he tried to push it through. And it's just not happening with the price tag that gets put on it. So I hate this bill from where we started, but it's still something, and it's still going to stop the releases around airports. But I think definitely continue to push for those other things, because they are super important.
Yeah, it does nothing for contamination, unfortunately, other than hopefully preventing future contamination. Yeah.
Well, no, but I mean, even if they could get it so insurance companies would cover testing, so you knew what kind of toxicity levels you were hit with, would be,
and then you're
the help having data. Discovered when you talk about no communication, okay. I was up in Barrow for 10 years drinking stuff way higher than what we've got here and didn't even know about it until I got the maps from her.
Yeah.
So
you know, I'd love to go get a blood test. Anyway, that was my, so I think in recommending some of our actions, we should do a formal letter of support with the city.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, we were just waiting to hear what their strategy was, because we definitely want to call out again the need to deal with the existing contamination and the problems with that people have with their water wells, whether they're municipal or private. And the question is whether we try to get them to add that into the bill, or we get them to follow up with a second bill, even if it's next session, you know, that maybe you've got to do it one step at a time.
I think everything that you want out of this, put it 5 years out.
Yeah.
That's going to be lucky.
Yeah. Well, I think there may be a good chance of getting this one through. And, you know, that's an important step, but then we got to move on to deal with the existing problem of groundwater, soil contamination, so forth.
And I think my concern with the EPA is if it doesn't apply to private wells.
Yeah, MCLs don't, as I understand. Yeah.
So, but when on the EPA Region 10 roundtable talk that they had, it was a lot of private well people advocating for consideration because, you know, very few private wells did it to themselves. Yeah. So.
But I guess it's a matter of how, I mean, they can enforce an MCL with a municipal public water supply. How do they enforce it on somebody's private well is another issue. You know, how do they even find out whether they need to enforce it?
Or, a grant program to have people resolve it on par with.
Yeah, I think advocating within the state is the only way to resolve that. I don't think that's going to come from the top down. And the rumor is that the state will follow suit with EPA. That's that was part of why I heard that the bill was reduced, because they assumed that DEC would follow suit.
Oh, that EPA was going to.
But Bill made it very clear that it was for public water supplies. And I mean, we know that the state tried a couple wells where they did the asphalt batch plant for public water supply solutions. And I think they tested positive. So
they were down there. They drilled one at the Patrick's shop.
Okay.
Yeah. And it is clean. And there's some progress happening, but I don't know the details.
Thanks for all your work.
We have a couple council members online. Tanya and Jim, do either of you have any questions? We don't want to miss you because you're not in the room right now.
This is Tanya, I guess.
I'm good. I've been listening, I'll look through the PowerPoint a little bit later.
Okay. Tanya, you were saying?
I guess, in looking at Wayne Howell's report, you know, there's a couple other locations, or I guess they're mostly around the airport. Are there any other places we strongly suspect another plume, or we think that the three plumes probably accurately are what we're dealing with? Any thoughts on that?
Either of you two have any areas that you're particularly...
Anywhere it was sprayed, it didn't go away.
Yeah.
We know that.
But we just don't know where that was.
Finding it and find, with the depth differences, some wells in areas that were known to have PFAS fire response are fine. It went deeper or shallower or whatever, the well missed it. But that doesn't mean that those people aren't living on PFAS contaminated ground and eating their chicken eggs from that area or whatever, gardening in that area. So anywhere that there was a release, I think at least soil samples and a monitoring well are warranted as a responsible move from a city that contaminated somebody's property.
Do you have any other any ideas about other sources other than AFFF, since there are so many products that use this?
Not significant have been used. Sources, but definitely everything else. I mean, from
I'm just the wondering Teflon if that's a cause of some of these other plumes, some yeah. other non-AFFF.
Not to those AFFF numbers.
I mean, yeah. I remember Kristen of Shannon Wilson saying, you know, it's surprising that we find any wells with non-detect. So the fact that we have as many was a shocker to her.
Yeah.
So I think the zero goal is much of Gustavus's background story.
A question that
Similar to what Tanya was asking. It seems that there was a discussion some years ago about the use of LIDAR to sort of perhaps project where the plume might flow to. Do you have any concerns or anticipations that it may be following groundwater routes in expanding?
So in the site characterization reports for both the airport and the plume to the east of the airport, they do model groundwater, projected groundwater movement, because all those monitoring wells, they record the depth to water, and groundwater moves downhill like everything else. So they do have some maps in there of the likely, you know, but it's not anything, it wouldn't surprise you that it's going from uphill to downhill and finding the ocean at some point. So the LIDAR will definitely capture a lot more of the superficial movement. And I think in most cases, the patterns are following what you would expect for downhill, but I still think that historic ditch that went to the Salmon River and trained a lot of the water, I think it's still moving a lot of groundwater from the airport to the river because it probably wasn't filled to the same
density. Pure sand backfill.
It wasn't filled to the same density and packing that it was when it was first dug out. So it's far more porous than other options. Path of least resistance.
So yeah, Kelly, you talked about the plume stop. Can you give us a little more information?
On that? So plume stop is ironically one of the very first things that Joanne Lesh suggested. She was like, I found this cool site. We should look into it. But it's colloidal activated carbon. So it's like super, super fine particles of activated carbon. And they inject it into the earth in a curtain around the point source or as close as they can get. So it retains, when the PFAS gets there, the charcoal retains it. And it holds onto it for a period of time until it's exhausted. And then it starts to allow flip through. We think that because of our source is finite, that it would be effective forever.
So like where would it be put in, or how?
That's what I think they're going to work on this summer. I'm hoping they're going to work on this summer somewhere around the Duck Pond, Shannon and Wilson. So that probably somewhere between where those ditches meet in the corner of the Duck Pond there.
And then can you elaborate a little more when you said about the Patrick's project?
I know that they had a well drilled, and I know that they're catching rainwater in order to be able to fill cisterns when there's not enough rain to fill them or when people exceed their collection.
Do they become a public water source?
I'm not sure. Definitely talk to them. It's part of the deal for giving us a clean water source that affected homes, that there's a source to when there's not rain.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I would assume that they would provide that service to the community at large if they were able to.
So how many homes do you think are affected?
I was thinking that based on the last map where I saw red dots, and that there might have been a few that got added subsequently, we were in the order of magnitude of about 23 right now. And so it would be a doubling if the EPA limits were applied to private wells here.
But aren't there also a lot of homes with that are within those, the immediate vicinity of those ones that are identified, that there's no reason to think they wouldn't be just as affected?
Depending on their well depth and whether or not they've been tested, and yeah.
I mean, even if they haven't been tested, their neighbors got it, they probably did.
It's surprising the variability. I mean, even how far are the two wells apart here, you know?
They're different depth though.
Yeah. Right. And almost no one in Casavis knows what their well is. So, yeah.
And so of the, how many homes have that are affected have had remediation done through DEC or DOT or who?
DOT is the one funding it. DEC oversees their them in some capacity, and Shannon and Wilson is the one doing the work on DOT's behalf. I would ask the Patricks that how many cisterns they've built. It's quite a few, but I don't have the number.
A ballpark number?
12-ish.
Oh, okay.
They've gotten most of the hot spot there done. Which, if the EPA's numbers go through and affect us, if DEC acts accordingly and passes that on down, then that'll all change. And I believe that they're expecting that. Patrick said.
We have written DOT, by the way, just about 3 weeks ago, asking them to move that pile again. I haven't had a response yet from them.
That seems like an easy action item for their pot of money, but more pressure.
Yeah.
So do you think as a short-term solution to people who have in their wells, those filters you talked about, is that a short-term viable solution?
Yeah.
And so we're talking 23 homes, maybe doubled that?
I think it depends on the comfort level of the home, but the goal is zero.
Sure, but I mean, I think that if there's there's a simple solution that can give at least any solution, and you're talking a $400 item, I think from the city's perspective, it would be a great investment to our community to provide those if you had a well that tested. I mean,
it could also double with city provided water tests that could increase the data base that we have.
I'm sorry, say that again.
It could also double with city provided water tests. So if you're interested in a Berkey, here, go test your water, bring back the test results, and then the city has those on file. Whitney can add them to the map, and they can get the filter and clean water if their water tests over 2 parts per trillion or whatever. I mean, there's no reason we can't have something that's lower than the state standards and be more active and prepared. Yeah. Well, and we GPAC provided tests for a while. We bought them and then sold them or gave them for donation. And people still ask me about it. We haven't had them for a couple of years, but people are definitely interested in testing their own water. So if they could come here and get a test, and they're not expensive, you can get, I can't remember the company, but there's a newer company that was doing it that was $100 a test or less. And we were using a lab in California that was $200 for the sample kit. And you can put it in a flat rate box.
Zoom, but I'm just going to pass this right back to you in a couple seconds. But I'm curious, I remember reading in the EPA documentation that their goal level and then their action level is so low is basically because you can't test lower than a certain threshold. Do you have that number off the top of your head? Is that 4 parts per trillion? Two is as low as a detectable sample?
A lab, but most Shannon and Wilson's come back with a detection limit around 2.
Okay, 2.
Good
to know. Gotcha.
Okay, any other questions? I think this discussion we need to continue maybe at another work session.
Yeah.
So it would give people a chance to look more at the data, and we can think about what is it the city can do. Obviously, we can do advocacy. We already have done some, and we can do a lot more. I have a quote. A proposal from Shannon Wilson to sample the water in the city hall, the fire hall, the library, and we're going to add the public or the community garden well, and to do it 3 times this year so we can look at variation over time. And we are changing out all of our charcoal filters and the elements on the RO system that we have, just as the initial mitigation measure that we can easily make to start. So that's kind of where we are right now. And we'll be promoting the SB
62, 67,
to at least get that. Hopefully, see if that'll make it through the legislature this year. So that's where we are right now. But if the city's going to expand its role, that's something we really need to talk about. You know, what sorts of things do we think we can do? Who's going to do it? How's it going to get done? How do we pay for it? And that sort of thing. So that's a discussion for us to continue. We've got a lot of other stuff on the agenda, so I think we probably better move to the rest of that, but I certainly appreciate you two coming in and giving us such a great update. I certainly feel much more informed now than I was before, so thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, guys, the other thing to do is to go through our planned agenda for the general meeting. And Janine asked for a break. So why don't we take about a 5-minute break and then we'll come back on this. Is that okay?
Thank you.
Or even 4 if we're done earlier. So, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for reminding me to turn that on. We've got a lot of stuff on the consent agenda that are things that are pretty, probably non-controversial. In fact, I think there was one item we could even add to that I saw farther down. We've redone position descriptions or updated them for the city clerk position. And we've done some editing on other position descriptions just to make them consistent in their format. And Karen Platt's done a great job on that. And Kathy has also contributed to add some minor writing changes in them that maybe adjust to make it more clear what these positions do. The one of the library positions listed the mayor as the supervisor when it should be the city administrator. So we fixed that. So that's what those things are about. And we've got some more. I think we'll have some more that we may update in this before too long too. Janine?
Just on those, did the people who are the like the librarian, did they have input on those?
Yeah, they gave us some input. We actually met with the librarians and that gave us some ideas for doing some modifications to theirs. They were the ones who pointed out the inconsistency on who they reported to and so forth. So do either of you want to add to that? You were more involved in it.
Basically, a lot of them weren't formatted the same. So Karen fixed all the formatting, making them all bullet points instead of numbers and bullet points or whatever. There was a few, you know, typos. There was a few things that didn't really explain the sort of amount of hours that is a part-time position, non-exempt versus exempt, and that needed to be clarified because that was a problem. And so basically it was just sort of cleaning up a lot of different things in there, including this, you know, supervisory things and mentions of committees that were no longer functional, you know, so those kind of things.
Karen, anything else to add on those? You did so much editing and reformatting.
There was definitely a lot of inconsistencies. There's some requirements in ordinance that were supposed to, you know, show in the position descriptions that not all of them had. Some of them were mishmashed. Even references to ordinance was mishmashed with policy. And so, yeah, they all needed a fine tooth comb. And I think we'll go over them one more time. There's a couple pieces missing from the city administrators that's supposed to be in there. But all of the positions are updated and formatted the same. And then I just included lastly in after all the position descriptions, an actual position announcement, which does not have to be approved by the council, but I just thought that I would throw it in there also because there were just many, many different versions out there. And so now there's one place where all the templates live, and whoever's writing a position description or a position announcement, they can have a correct template to work off of.
Great. And am I correct that I think we've made some more edits to the library ones for some consistency in their writing since the packet was done for the work right, session. They'll be in the new thing, but they're really just minor change, you know, adding an S on the end of a word and that sort of thing.
The link to them is linking the current ones. The only question I had was we didn't accept the changes on the DRC one for some reason. Paul updated it because he's retiring and he integrated the more current operator one that you guys had approved not long ago for Ian and took his duties and combined them into that because his hadn't been updated since 2014.
But we don't have his on the agenda, right? I don't see it.
They're all on the agenda.
I'm sorry. Let me.
I'm only seeing eight, nine. And
clarify here for just a second.
You're only seeing the
seven, eight, nine on here.
Can I help you out?
Please.
So I updated the packet shortly before the meeting. I sent an email out. It was probably too close to the meeting for you to have noticed it, but I changed the agenda item to read all the updating all department position descriptions, and all of them have been put into the packet and it's been updated online, and I sent you guys the link, but it was probably too close to the meeting for you to have seen that.
Right.
They're all in there now.
I'm looking at the printed copy here. Okay, good. So if you want to look at the, you know, interested in the details on those, read through them, but they're the recommendation of the city administrator and the clerk, and I accept their recommendations myself. So, okay, moving on, we'll have, there's a project scoping document in there for the cul-de-sac improvements. I've talked about that project before. I think you're aware of it. And we're gonna do that we also have an NCO on the agenda to introduce, I think, to pay for that. And the plan is to spend $35,000 out of capital funds but using the road maintenance contract as the vehicle for contracting, getting the work done. And we're pretty confident we can get major improvements on five of these cul-de-sacs for about $35,000 total. And that actually includes quite a bit of improvement on Glenn's Ditch Road from the corner of same old road down to the Nagoonberry parking area. So so you can look that one over unless you have any questions for me on that right now. Okay. We have a very small project we're going to do as a small capital project to fix the community chest door. That's the one on the storage building, the one that's on the left, and it's, I think, a double door. And it's just falling apart and rotten old age and everything. And so we're going to replace that door. We don't have any funding in here yet for that, but we'll follow up with a NCO to fund that. But it's maybe a $4,000 project or something like that to replace that door. And right now you can't even lock it or anything. So then we're introducing an NCO for additional money for the septage storage facility. And that's, what is it, like 42,000?
So
I got to flip to it. Great. Great. And
there was equipment issues. There was one fiberglass patch issue. There was several different things that we had to get together and our permit. And so it's apparently scheduled for the Monday ferry.
Okay. So yeah, we're hoping to move forward with that soon. That's a project that I think is going to benefit the community pretty generally, because there's so many septic tanks around, and some of them are long overdue for being pumped and are on the verge of failure. So we want to enable people to have pumping service, and it's going to do that. So John Berry is managing that project. There's another one, NCO introduction, AMLIP FY23 R&R, and that's to put money, the treasurer can correct me if I'm incorrect here, but that's putting money into our repair and replacement account line. It's budgeted in our every year in our operating budget to move money from the income of that year into those R&R savings accounts. Did I get describe that properly?
It should have been done back in July or August, and it just got missed. So I'm doing last year's now, and we'll be doing another one in July or August for the fiscal next year fiscal coming year, up.
Yeah, normally we do it pretty early in the year, but it doesn't really matter when we do it during the year, just so we get it done. And then the next one, in fact, Ben, you might give a description on this one, the introduction for the NCO to move surplus money from our checking account, where we have way too much money sitting there making no money, into a couple of AMLIP lines, road maintenance and capital improvements, I think. Explain that.
That's correct. Capital improvements, long-term and road maintenance. And the money is to bring it down to within 35% of our budget, which is where we would like to have our bank account, so that we've got our additional funds in a interest-bearing account, not in our checking account.
Right. Okay, good. And then we go to ordinance for public hearing. We have an NCO that we introduced last month, and that's to fund the radio repeater tower installation. And that project is, the bids on that are about to, remind me, did that one close?
That one closed.
Yeah, I'm trying. We had several of these going. I was trying to remember which one. That one closed. The septic one is the only one that's open right now, I think. Yeah. So we need a little more money to make that one happen. And so that's what that NCO is for. And in fact, pull it up on, what was it, like 55,000 or something on the NCO for the radio repeater tower?
That's 55,900.
55,900. Thanks. Yeah. I'm working through this paper copy and it's hard to flip through and find it all. So that'll be up for public hearing and approval and will enable us to move forward and get that tower installed. And then we have the award of that project on the agenda. That's item 16. And that's the, okay. Yeah, there's the letter on the identification of the winning bidder. Glacier Bay Construction will be doing that project, and the NCO mat will match the amount of in the award or in that they bid. So we'll be okay on getting that done. The next one will be to award the septage holding tank facility, and that RFQ is still out for. To bid, and I think it closes on the 7th, something like that. And so we don't know yet who will be the low bidder on that. And we have at least two outfits that have been interested in bidding it. So we may get a couple of bids at least, and we'll get the bid in time to get it onto the agenda for award this month. And so we do want to get that done while we want to get the tanks in the ground while the water table is lowest in like May and June if possible. So that's why we've got it. We need to move forward on this expeditiously. Okay, any questions on anything so far? If I missed anybody, I guess not seeing anything on the screen. And then we have, we've spent a lot of time on the budget and we're ready to actually introduce it. So what we'll do as a new business item, we will introduce the NCO. We're not gonna put this on the consent agenda like we do some of the NCOs just due to the nature of it. So we'll it'll be on new business and subject to public comment. But the comments should be about whether or not to introduce it. And then we're scheduled it for public hearing next month, May 8th. And at that time, if there are not any big issues with it or problems from the public that cause us to delay it, we can proceed to adopt the budget for the next fiscal year in May, which would be nice. It gets that big piece of our business behind us, and we can move forward on other stuff without continuing to deal with the budget. But if there needs to be adjustments to it, we can do that. And we are expecting that once we know what our carryover is from this year, after we get past July 1st and into the next fiscal year, then we'll take a look at whether we want to redistribute some more of that carryover into the budget. There are some places where we may have left a little bit, some funding for some budget lines a little thin, so we can adjust them at that point and then put the rest in savings or whatever we want to do with it. There's also an introduction for the cul-de-sac improvements project, an NCO for that. And I think that's the 35,000. Yep. So we're going to introduce, in fact, should we put that one in the consent agenda, Madam Clerk? So item 19, at least on the version I'm looking at, it was item 19. I think it's probably.
Nineteen.
we're talking about the cul-de-sac improvements. We can put the the scoping document and the NCO both on the consent agenda, and then if somebody wants to pull it off, they can. We can do that.
Is there any PFAS thing we need to think about in terms of thinking particularly Glen Stitch?
We're not down in the ditch. We'll just be working on the road. There's actually quite a bit of space between the road and the ditch. We fortunately have a really wide piece of easement there. It's amazingly wide just because of the way the lots came together. So we've got a lot of room there. I don't think we've got a PFAS issue on that, or actually on any of the other ones. They're mostly on the other side, you know, quite a ways away from the existing known PFAS contamination. Okay, so we'll slip that one back up into the consent agenda. And then if somebody has an issue or if the public wants to pull it off and say something about it, then they can do that. Okay, then the next item is to approve the City of Gustavus Capital Improvement Plan, which we've talked about before, and that's in the packet. Is that something you want to think about?
Things that in view of the, again, PFAS, I don't believe we have anything in the Capital Improvement Plan for addressing PFAS. Is that something we would want to consider if we're looking at an improvement plan for 23 to 27?
We could, of course, we can make, whether or not it's in the capital improvement plan or not, we can still start up a capital project if we're doing a capital project like that. In fact, that might, or we can also put stuff into the operating budget if we wanted to use that as a funding means for doing something on PFAS. So I don't know that we need to add it into the capital plan. We can always add stuff to the capital plan anytime too. So we kind of reapprove that plan or think about it each time. Unfortunately, Ben's kind of narrowed that plan down and reorganized it so it's much more concise now. And it does cover things that we've already got done in the last year, things that we're planning to do this year and how they are funded, whether or not they've been funded, and then some long range things that are mostly just a list of things that we might want to do. So I don't know that we have to add it to it, but you think it's useful and do something like that.
If I might make a suggestion, so two things. One is we're just getting told about funding coming through, federal sources that may address this, but we don't even know who's getting them, how they're being allocated. They haven't really rolled out the guidance on it yet. But our question, and one of the things, point of hearing some of this stuff tonight is, who do we go to at the state to find out how these funds might be rolling through and how do they intend to use them? So we don't know enough yet to even know what to ask at this point. We're just delving into it because we've been so involved with other funding sources. So you could amend, put an amendment statement in there about, once we figure out funding alternatives or something for that, maybe you want it to be a priority, or maybe you just want to wait till we find out more about what's coming down the pike for that. So those are my two suggestions on that.
Any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, the one thing I can think of that would be a clear capital project in regards to PFAS is the Quagga plume stopper they're talking about, but that would be something that we would we wouldn't, I mean, can, do we even have the authority to put that in on land that we don't own? Because that, yeah, that main plume that they would want to contain would be on DOT controlled land. So that complicates.
That plume stop would really be a barrier to stop the contamination. That's the responsibility of DOT and PF. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to continue to work with them to encourage that to happen. I'm frankly concerned about, I think we have to be careful what we take on for responsibility around PFAS, because it could really eat our lunch and everything else.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, like right now we have no municipal water system, and so we're not responsible for meeting MCLs on a municipal water system, and we have no responsibility whatsoever for private wells. So if we're going to do something like that, we have to think carefully about what we're committing us to. And there's so many wells right now, but then some more people move in and then they want their well treated or whatever, you know. So those are things we have to think pretty carefully about, whether the extent that we want to get into it. And that's why I think we need some more discussion time in a work session.
So if I may add, though, as I'm looking at this, we actually do have a mid-range project, public drinking water point source project development. Project would contract with a company to produce a report that will identify a water source to create a point source public. And it goes on. So there is something actually addressing that in our mid.
Yeah. Level. And that was something that Tom put in. And because we were thinking about whether, you know, back a couple of years ago, even about whether we might want to do a public water source. And so we listed that as a possibility, and it remains a possibility, but that would mean running a public water system, having the technicians doing all the testing, meeting all the water quality requirements, and it's big. Even if we don't have a distribution system, even if it's just like Fox Spring up in Fairbanks, or, you know, where you can pick up water at a site with your own truck or something in your tank, we'd still be having to meet all of the requirements for running a municipal water supply. So,
and we wouldn't want to even enter into anything like that until we had a session with our attorney. So
there'd be all kinds of things to and consider whether, I mean, we might be able to get grants to build the thing, but that won't cover operating it. So there's a lot of stuff to think about, whether we want to get into those things or not.
But at least we've documented in our mid-range that one of the plans in progress, the preferred project plan, will be to apply for a Village Safe Water grant for a study to determine the need and best approach to create and operate a water utility. Yeah. So I think
I'm in on the safe water grant.
I haven't heard back from them, but we have a $75,000 planning grant in for septage, which I'm sure it's not for water, but just even talking about the septage issue and being able to ship it out, it may include some considerations during that time.
To go into the supply side. Other comments or questions about the Kelly?
I'd like to move forward a little bit with the Wilson Road culverting and ditching, and am wondering if I'd like to perhaps, I mean, I would offer to volunteer to update the 2018 project scoping and development on the Wilson Road. And because it seems that in the description, it's fairly lean and also refers to engineers' recommendations and the LIDAR, is this something where we can supplement a project with more definition and more details?
We could.
We can do that, after passing the concept and then finally.
Sure, I think what we may want to do is do a new scoping document for the mm-hmm. rest of Wilson Road.
Mm-hmm.
And because we've done a lot of work and we've done it in an iterative manner,
mm-hmm.
and we need to extend that substantially, we could certainly write up a new scoping document, mm-hmm. describe the project, and fund it out of our capital funds with an NCO.
I guess I'd been wondering about the LIDAR. I can't say that I've ever heard any report. Has that work been done? And could we get a report?
The LIDAR mapping was done. We've got raw data. Mm-hmm. We have no maps. We really need the help of somebody like Whitney, who's expert on LIDAR and the data, to know how to use it. Todd Boris look it over, and he looked at the data. He has some experience working with LIDAR data for drainage things, but we can't use Todd now because DOT told him he can't work for the city, even as a volunteer or anything. So, I don't know that we really need the LIDAR data to do the Wilson. We know where the water wants to go. We know what the slope is down the road. So mm-hmm. that part's pretty simple. There are some other areas in the community where it would be more helpful, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, like maybe Willow Way, mm-hmm. and those down there, for example. So, yeah, we can develop a project. Right now, I'm just trying to get the ones that we got going, you know, mm-hmm. done, started and done, and we kind of do them one after another.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, but I'd be glad to work with you on it if you want.
I'd be happy to.
Okay. Anything else on the capital improvement plan that will be? So it's fairly straightforward thing to just. It's useful. I should note one of the useful things about it too is when we apply for a grant, a lot of times they want to know, is this part of a general planning document that you have? And we can use that capital improvement plan as documentation that we have been thinking about this for a while, this particular project. And so that's perhaps the greatest use for it. But it also summarizes for now where we are on a number of these projects, their funding and so forth. Okay. If you want to look through that plan, do so, and you'll notice details like Janine just did. So, then we've got a resolution approving our certified financial statement. Ben, do you want to say anything about that annual certification we do?
I don't have anything to say, but if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. That could go into the consent agenda as long as no one has a problem with that. Karen has a problem with that.
It's a resolution. It's required that we read it out loud, an ordinance.
We can read it out loud as part of the consent agenda, but maybe it's just easy to do it as a new business item. Okay.
So, Ben, can you just summarize for us what it is?
It's basically every year, in order to be in compliance with certain state and federal guidelines, we have to do an overall financial statement for the city. So, because at the end of the fiscal year, everything isn't necessarily closed out, it doesn't happen on July 1st. As the POs and everything get closed out, that's how it is. But it's an overall statement of the city's overall financial picture for the year. So that includes the AMLIP accounts, that includes the endowment fund account. It's the statement that we'll use for things like the cap and the different programs that we apply to. That's what we send along with our application to say, this is where we're at when we're asking for funds. So that's, if you look it over, the reason I said I'd answer questions is because it doesn't necessarily jive with the financial reports that I give you, because the financial reports I give you don't include all those additional things. So this is a overall view to be in compliance with the state and federal agencies.
One other question is, I'm just, so this is self-certified basically. It's just us saying we certify this.
It's true as we know that that's, and it's basically, you know, like I didn't go and search for this information. It's a report that we've created in QuickBooks that QuickBooks just produces for us.
In order to get our PILT money, our roads, national forest receipts, and our CAP community assistance program, they want to know that we're paying attention to our books and they look okay and our numbers. Like he said, a lot of times you don't really close everything out until the end of December from the previous fiscal year because of all the lagging things. So this is in lieu of like next year, how we're going to have to do an audit, a real audit. This is, so they want this and a link to our approved budget in order to get our funds. So once the budget's approved, we send them a link. And once this is approved, we send them the copy of the resolution. So.
Gotcha.
Okay. We're okay on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That takes the last item. And this one, we've got two versions of a resolution that I originally wrote up the first one. And then Shelley and Brian have worked on another version of it to pick up some of the ideas that originally Shelley had. And maybe the best thing would be for you guys to describe what the changes were that you made and why you recommend those changes.
Do you want to start with that, Shelley? I feel like maybe we could start at your thoughts because you had laid out so nicely in a kind of separate document, kind of laying out your concerns and what we were trying to address. And maybe that could be a good starting point.
Sure. That's, it's, of course, it's all item 22, but let's see here. Down about line 5 or 6, I said that I oppose language that requires salaries and raises be competitive in the state of Alaska labor market measured against communities with vastly different economic capacities of population, industry, property taxes, and other income sources.
Hang on a second. Are we on the resolution part or the procedures, policy and procedures?
We're in her thoughts right mm-hmm. now, the kind of trying to lead into what we were trying to address.
Oh, so okay, got it. Yeah. Okay, I thought she was referring to something I was lost.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
I wanted to kind of narrow down. I didn't want to be measuring a Gustavus position up against communities that have property taxes and other, you know, large income basis. And so that was one of my concerns.
Can you explain why that is? Why does property tax matter?
I would be better prepared next week, actually. I was traveling last week and so I don't have my thoughts together, but I'll be happy to make a presentation next week.
Oh, okay. What I was thinking about doing is if everybody liked your version, we just take it and put it on the agenda. Oh. I mean, either one's, I'm sure, is.
Now, the very last one, is that a new version? It looks like the policies and procedures, that's the on pages 151 and 152. Is that new crafting?
Say again.
I can see that.
151, yep.
Okay, so it looks like we start with your initial version of the resolution and the policies and procedures, and then the policies and procedures and resolution draft that Brian and I worked on. And then the very last document, policy and procedure, is that something new that you put together after we submitted our comments and our proposed version?
No. Okay. I haven't done any work on this since then.
Okay.
Since I did was the original one. Mm-hmm. And you guys thought that, or you particularly thought that there were some things that you would like to see worded differently. So I suggest you guys get together and make us a proposal. I think it's important that these policies be, reflect the input of council members, not just the mayor. And, so I'm inclined to just accept, put yours on the agenda, because I'm sure it's just as workable as mine. So I just want, the idea was to set forth make it a regular thing to look at salaries and provide some guidance for how, for whether we need to adjust salaries at the time that we are doing the operating budget. Mm-hmm. And essentially we've done that this year. But in the past, sometimes salary adjustments have been disjunct from the operating budget development. And I think we needed to be more orderly and look at them together so that the operating budget reflects any salary adjustments that we think are appropriate at that time. So, the idea was just to set forth a way of doing that, but to leave some, flexibility. There's obviously going to be a lot of judgment involved on the part of the city administrator, the mayor, so forth. The important thing is to have a procedure that that guides the mayor and city administrator each year to remind them to do that stuff.
I agree with you on that. I think basically what we kind of did was started with the resolution and kind of simplified the resolution and then put more of the details into the policies and procedures. And my concern were about, the diminishing income. We're not going to have all of this federal money that we've relied on for the last couple of years. And I would like to see salaries be based on our taxes. And Brian was going to sort of reserve the right to argue for a little more of an expansive interpretation that you could talk about that, but also that we, I was concerned initially about the COLA because Department of Labor, says that doesn't apply to rural areas, but, everybody's convinced me, it's a standard that we don't necessarily have to, it's not a mandate, but it's a factor to consider. So in in the policies and procedures, we set out, it looks like there's, I guess, six different factors to look at and evaluating, for example, like number six, projected city tax revenues, expenses, and the ability to fund any recommended pay increases. Because once salaries are increased, it kind of grows from there and becomes, a greater and greater sort of financial burden on the community in the city. So that is, like I say, I'm being a little scattered here,
I think you said, you're saying the same thing that I did too. Essentially, we have to consider our financial condition as part of any decision on changing salaries, increasing them. And
projection into the future.
I don't think there'd be any.
Yeah. So I guess page.
I object to that, the way you wrote it.
I think page 147. Those six factors is kind of are basically what we would be looking at. So I'm
I think you're in the new version of the packet. So look at 160. Look at 167. Yeah, look at 167. Yeah, and that'll be the second page of the collaborative draft of our resolution.
When I go 167. I don't have 167.
I've got page 150, 151, and
152,
and the paper one.
I mean, I pulled it up when I was here. I've got
167 up.
I mean, that's, I didn't. I opened it when I arrived here.
Yeah.
It's the packet.
You could refresh it and it might change. Actually, you might have to go back to the meeting agenda mm-hmm. page and then pull it up because it might have a different mm-hmm. code at the end of the file name.
Oh, did you want to fix it for me? It turned sideways. Oh, I see. That's not a refresher.
So if I can, while we're
sure.
kind of adjusting here, speaking broadly, I would say what Shelley and I were looking at achieves the same central goals that you were looking to take care of in your resolution. The differences that we ended up making were particularly around Shelley being nervous about terms that could potentially be conceived as locking us into, you know, having to compete with the broader Alaskan market. So you'll note that references to competitive salaries or the market value of someone's wage, those were removed. And then you also have Shelley's concern about us being compared against other areas with different economic conditions. So there you'll see in the second line item of the new resolution, or sorry, the new policy and procedure, where she's listing out the potential things to review, basically a definition of, you know, kind of what you had already discussed, but it wasn't, you know, crystallized in the policy and procedure. So, you know, kind of crystallizing that of compensation for similar positions in comparable rural communities and what that might look like. But then my concern was that I didn't want to make this too prescriptive by listing too many things out. So you'll note right. that right at the start of the procedure, it says that the mayor shall review pay rates and anticipated hours for each position based on the duties, responsibilities, educational requirements, and relevant experience, and with consideration of, but not limited to, the following economics. So it's not trying to box someone in necessarily, but more saying these are things that have been helpful to consider and that probably ought to be considered. So trying to find the balance of providing the context for things that are worth considering so that we're, you know, not trying to compare salaries to Juneau or Anchorage, but still give the future people implementing these policies enough leeway to have that flexibility to make the decisions they need to make, so that, you know, your example you used was maybe look at a fire lieutenant in Juneau. So, you know, it doesn't have to be the exact same position. So it's kind of a mix of addressing Shelley's concerns, but not boxing us in too tightly. And I'm sorry, Janine, you were asking a question before this. Were you not as you,
in terms of
I feel like I interrupted at one point. But
oh, no.
Like are we all on the same page as far as
yeah.
where we're, are we looking at the same document?
Okay.
Yeah.
So Janine, our page numbering is different, but if you look for the yellow footer on policies and procedures, and yeah. it's the one that says policies and procedures collaborative 317-23, that's yeah. one we're looking at. And then the factors are on that, the last page, there's six factors.
Yeah.
Yeah. The resolution has the yellow highlight,
yeah.
collaborative, mm-hmm. but then it's followed, but the following, the policy and procedure that follows it is what you wrote to match your new resolution, right?
Yeah. Another notable change in this one versus last one is Shelley made me aware of a resolution that, let's see, CY19-16. So I think that was passed in fiscal year 19, that specifically laid out a resolution that the city had already passed that said, so there was specific verbiage from that that's been put into both the resolution as well as the policy and procedure, where it says the city shall conservatively balance revenues with expenses, including the cost of employee compensation, and consider carefully the potential for unanticipated reductions in revenue or increases in costs due to emergencies such as may occur during the fiscal year or in future fiscal years. And that seemed prudent.
I wrote that one in 2019.
Yeah. So.
And it's been misinterpreted by some to say that there is that that the salary budget is somehow tied to tax revenue specifically, and it doesn't do that. We deliberately did not do that, even though some of the public wanted that.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we don't want to get, I mean, the other sources of revenue are just as important as sales tax, for example.
Yeah, so then
and some of them are even more reliable. But I guess, you know, I'm sure your version would certainly be workable.
Well, I'll draw your attention then to the one point of, I don't want to say contention, but the one point of difference in opinion that Shelley and I still had on the document, which I think I'm going to have to, looks like the version that Shelley submitted probably has it. Basically, in one of her concerns was making sure that salaries are tied to and limited by tax revenue. And it was more in your camp and didn't see how revenue is revenue and it all comes into the same pool. And I mean, if all of the federal funds disappear and we're still going to have to pay the road contractors, so what does it matter what the salary budget is? And I just have a hard time understanding how that made sense. And so I think that my plan, I'm going to have to find it in here, but if the version that is in the packet that Shelley submitted is the one that aims to limit wage increases to our tax revenue, then I had planned to add an addendum or, you know, a motion to modify it to just say, you know, ongoing revenue, something that speaks more broadly, you know, to still try and capture, we're not trying to go spend out of savings, but we're not going to arbitrarily limit salaries to tax revenue just because there's a,
you know, where does it say that? I should find, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't, I should have studied this more carefully before the meeting here and I forgot to do that.
You're fine.
So
I'm trying to find it myself. I mean, I haven't looked at this.
We may have resolved that in suggestion. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That may. Mine only goes to 5 on the Parliamentary Procedure.
On the, you have the ones with the the yellow footer?
It's not a footer. No, it's got a header. This is the one that was that we published as the packet for this meeting. Oh, okay. I see what you mean. So is that okay? Yeah. So that one is yours. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if we need to spend more time on this, we certainly can. We've already done this activity for this year anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're trying to do is capture the process and tie it down for future year to make it a guidance, you know, provide guidance for future years.
Yeah. And I think that this version does that. And I'm actually really happy with what we put together. And as Kathy just noted, that the only place I'm actually seeing that explicitly mentioned is in 6, which is in the kind of suggested area. I had imagined for some reason in my head that was mentioned somewhere. We might have taken it out of the resolution, but there was.
Well, and the way you have 6 written is I think is fine with me, because that's part of our, I mean, projected tax revenues is certainly part of the assessment where we wouldn't want to be making, I mean, we might decide that we can't afford to make some increases that we might want to do just because we think we're anticipating a lower tax year. Certainly makes sense. Kathy?
Can I point a couple of things out? So you're saying projected city tax revenues. You did not say projected city sales tax revenue. So the PILT money is a tax revenue and the national forest receipts is a tax revenue. It just comes from different sources. It's just not sales tax revenues. Mm-hmm. So if you keep it like that, then we should be fine because we're going to have to anticipate those.
Mm-hmm.
That we note that it is, we maybe even take out city and just say projected tax revenues or, you know, other revenues or something.
City revenues.
Yeah, yeah. I would say that. But if you're thinking that we can just do it on sales tax revenues, then yeah, I mean, that's.
We get a lot of revenue from fees too, like the DRC and so forth. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and those are all, it's all good money.
Those are all part of our projected expenditures in our budget, so.
Well, they're part of the income.
Well, so, I know, but yeah. Okay. So I meant it goes into the pot to offset the expenditures is my point. It's the fees.
Yeah, I would probably oppose an expansion of that because, I mean, I would like to see salary increases be based on sales tax revenue because it means if we are not bringing in enough money through sales taxes to pay for salaries, then we have to dip into some other pot, which we may need for another function of city government. So, you're scowling.
But it's all fungible. The money is all fungible. Well, not entirely. The forest receipts money is not fungible, but our other revenues are, and even to some extent roads are, because money that we get from forest receipts, we don't have to spend from other sources. But to me, there's nothing special about, you know, sales tax revenue. Of course, we also have bed tax and we have all kinds of other sources, and they all go into they're all part of the revenue pot. And they all vary a little bit with each year. And so there's always some uncertainty. And that's why we have to be conservative in our budget planning. It probably doesn't, you know, won't make a lot of difference to, you know, the mayor and city administrator next year. Regardless of how we write that, though. So, but I mean, I want it to reflect what the council wants, not just what I want. So,
well, I mean, okay, so let's just say when you're, especially if they start doing these carbon offsets and we start getting some of that revenue instead of forest receipts or something like that. What if we do have a low sales tax revenue, but let's say we get, you know, double the amount in our cap or our PILT or something like that? Why wouldn't we want to use that to fund city activities? And I guess, you know, it's like you may get so much over here and you can spend all that money on everything else except for salaries. So you're sort of sequestering it, I guess, is the way I'm looking at it. And it hamstrings you in your overall operational budget. And so that's the way I think as long as you budget conservatively all the way around for the entire budget, that's not to say you still don't study this and maybe you can't get a full increase or whatever for that year. I mean, well, I see what you're saying, but.
So do you think that you said that word?
Tanya's got her hand up and haven't been watching the screen. So Tanya, I'm sorry, we haven't let you chip in. Your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks. I think this is a great discussion. And just was curious about, there is a resolution on the books, I believe, that the city passed maybe several years ago about not spending more than comes in tax income, right? I don't remember the details of that. Maybe Shelley does, but it seems like might be relevant here to at least, you know, if that's a resolution we have on the books, to stay consistent with that.
That's what Brian brought up a few minutes ago, and maybe he can. Do you want to reread it? You want to read it or something? Or
I don't have the whole resolution here, but we included. Shelley incorporated by reference, basically, and I wasn't aware of it, but I think you might be referring to CUI 19-16.
Yeah, in the policy section, about three quarters of the way down.
Yeah, I think it's also in the resolution too. I can scroll down and double check. Yeah, that's the last whereas in the amended resolution that Shelley and I worked on also has that incorporated there. But it doesn't specifically say taxes. It sounds like Mike worked on it and they intentionally left that out. So as kind of our discussion is leaning towards, for the same reasons, we don't want to unnecessarily encumber funds on. I still don't fully understand the principle of why you would. Yeah, so it says conservatively balances revenues with expenses is kind of the core of that.
Right.
I mean, I think that covers the heart of what we're looking to do is, you know, we want to be fiscally prudent. But yeah, I'm just averse to unnecessarily, you know, encumbering a certain source of revenue or limiting a certain source of expense to one category when you know, as Kathy's mentioned, potentially we have an alternate source of revenue, and then I guess we could just amend the resolutions, et cetera, or amend the policies and procedures. But anyway.
So what do you want to do with this? Do you want to go forward with one version of this? Do you want both versions on alternatively for some sort of motion to substitute one for the other? What would you guys like to do?
Well, let's see. I think
Jean's got a comment.
Well, after having listened to the discussion on that point number six, I would definitely want to take the word tax out and go with, if we were to put this one, to have it be projected city revenues, expenses, and the ability to fund any recommended pay increases. Just is the taking that word tax out so that we aren't bound by that. Or, and I think also misinterpreted. I think that, as you guys have been saying, opens it up for an interpretation that, because what is a tax? And I think that someone reading that might not know it in its full definition. And therefore, I think it would be better to take it out so that it couldn't be misinterpreted.
I think I would be happier to remove the word city, but leave the word tax in. This tax, or at least as Kathy was suggesting, that the that it's a broader use of tax revenues that may or may not be just the city sales tax. I wouldn't consent to removing tax, because again, it's a factor. It's not a mandate. It's one of the factors to be considered.
Yeah, I mean, worst case scenario, we could have the first non-unanimous vote in my term on council. I mean, that wouldn't be the worst thing. But yeah, that how I had imagined going forward with this was with Shelley's version as the only one on the agenda, and then probably putting a motion to amend to change tax to either ongoing revenues or just projected city revenues. So that's, I mean, I think that's probably maybe the way to go forward with it and just
put I would support that.
Tanya's got her hand up again, I think.
Oh yeah, sorry, that was a leftover hand, but I do have another thought in terms of, and I haven't, you know, I'm kind of behind the game and a little confused with all the different versions that are out there, but I would want to make sure that it's not written in that someone's salary would decrease for a year because the city's not bringing in income. You know, I think we can decrease people's hours, but once they make a certain amount, so I just want to make sure that was covered in whatever version we go forward with.
I don't think that we actually addressed that possibility. My feeling was that it would require some awfully extenuating circumstances if we were going to reduce somebody's salary. I mean, there's some years when inflation is negative. It's happened. And we just didn't do an increase, a COLA increase for those years, but we didn't reduce salaries. I don't think we're going to go there, but if you think that's enough of a concern to put it in, we can certainly do that.
If I can chime in, I think that it's probably good as it is. Just under the first bit of procedure, it says the mayor shall review pay rates and anticipated hours. We could break that out into more detail, but I feel like the two of those in combination kind of cover that concern. I mean, I guess that's making the assumption that the natural choice would be to reduce hours and not a pay rate, but I feel like that's a pretty safe assumption, you know what they say about assumptions, though.
Kathy, you look like you're about to say something.
Well, whatever you guys decide, whatever version, doesn't matter to me. I just want to ask the question, and you said you were going to look more into this and have it more ready to explain at the meeting, the general meeting, right? Mm-hmm. For number two. Because I still do not understand what the community tax burden has, like, if they say because they've got a community tax burden in places like Fairbanks and Juneau and Anchorage, so they pay more to live there because they paid taxes and we don't, but there's other things that offset that. And maybe I'm not understanding the use of this, but it would be really good to explain why that should be a consideration, because we may have a lower tax burden, but we have a higher cost of living for lots of other things. So that's why I know this was introduced by various people, but I just would like to know the relevancy of it for determining this particular thing.
Well, specifically since I guess what my point is that, you know, it's one of six factors to be evaluated, be considered, and I would hate to remove just consideration of sales taxes or taxes. Right now it just says taxes. From consideration in setting a salary. So I guess I don't see why we would not consider sales taxes or other taxes in determining salaries.
See, I thought the theory behind the tax burden was because of what collected property taxes are in certain areas. And so they divide that by their population and they come up with the burden. For example, if you look at the North Slope, you're going to see the tax burden there. It's over $55,000 a person, but that's because they collect all these property tax revenues from Prudhoe Bay. That doesn't mean that's what the people are paying there. You know what I mean? That are sitting in there. And I'm saying we don't have a property tax, but our costs may be way higher than the people paying property taxes in Juneau and Anchorage and Fairbanks, because they're not paying $189 to fly out of town just to get to another airport, or they're not paying $5 and whatever cents a gallon for gas. And so I guess if we're going to use that and say, well, we don't have a big property tax burden, so we shouldn't follow the consumer price index as is set by Anchorage, then I'm just wondering how that aligns compared to what it cost us to live here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and if there's an explanation, that'd be great. I just know it was suggested by some people that we take a look at that, but it's like apples and oranges. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We referenced the document, in addition with the Municipal League Salary and Benefit Survey. I guess it's the, number two, community tax burden is determined by Department of Commerce. Well, I guess you have a clearer understanding of what the tax burden is when I look and see that, you know, Gustavus has a pretty solid tax burden that we're paying more than, you know, a number of communities. I don't have the document with me.
I looked at it.
Our sales tax is really low.
Our sales tax is low. We have a low tax burden. And I think that's the point that was being made by the person who was trying to say, we can't compare to the price index, inflation, consumer price index, because those people have $2,000 property taxes and we don't.
Mm-hmm.
So why should we? What I was hearing and understanding was, why should we get the value of that full 5.4% when those people are paying $2,000 plus a year in property taxes and we aren't? And I'm saying it balances out because we're paying so much for so many other things. And so that's why I was asking about the relevancy of it. And maybe I don't understand it, but I went and looked at it and I looked at the list of all of the boroughs and the cities, and I could see, you know, why some of theirs are so high, but that doesn't make their cost of living be higher than it costs to live here necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the only thing I was hoping for an explanation on, when this was explained, just so that it's more broadly understood. That was my point.
What we want to do here, we want to treat our employees fairly and appropriately. We don't want to lose employees because we're underpaying or something like that. We realize they have other opportunities. That's the market competition, the competitive market issue. And we just want to make sure that that we're a good employer. At the same time, we want to be getting good value for our money, of course, so we don't want to overpay. But we need to be aware that they have other opportunities all the time, and people can move, and especially in a tight labor market like we've got now, they got lots of opportunities. They may not necessarily be local, but some of them are, might move. So that's the, as long as what we're coming up with is going to support that idea, I'm okay with it. And tax revenues are a piece of it, but they're not the only revenue that I would consider, but you haven't said in there that that is the only thing, but tax revenues are, of course, an important piece of the picture. I mean, not just for employee pay, but for everything else in the budget.
So I have a question too on that. And so I'm not clear why a per capita tax revenue at the end of number two is important, because, I don't see per capita acquired being relevant to what someone's salary is. And I'm thinking that number three says what we really want, and that it's the market rate for relevant positions in Alaska municipalities, as referenced in the Alaska Municipal League's Local Government Salary and Benefit Survey. That to me seems...
That's one of our key things.
It's one of the key things, exactly. And so I think that number two is... I'm agreeing with Kathy, it doesn't seem overly relevant, when what we really are saying is that we want to make sure we have it be within the market range for relevant positions in Alaska municipalities.
We'd have to think about how we did that, how we applied that number two, I suppose.
Yeah, I had understood it, and I'm not sure, but I had understood number two to kind of be about the tax burden on the individual. I'm trying to, make sure we weren't paying someone who is coming from a rural community that has a high tax burden, since they're coming here to a place with a relatively low tax burden. But I think Kathy makes a good point talking about how that could potentially be rephrased to more consider cost of living broadly, although I don't know if we have a specific source of information about cost of living that's really super reliable that we can reference. Yeah, so I'd be just as happy to see that either reworded just to, be a nudge to say, consider the cost of living and here are some things that go into that, or to presume that we cover that in. Yeah, I think that's, I guess, what I have written out here that I'm imagining I would amend this with in a motion next week would be to adjust number two to more broadly reflect cost of living, because that seemed to be the point that it was aimed at. And then in number six, to broaden that to just projected city revenues. So that's where I'm at with this.
Wow. Yeah, I think I really resonate with what you're saying there, especially because we're using this as guidance, right? We don't want to, as Kathy put it, hamstring and put, especially number six, the word tax in there, because is tax not a form of revenue?
It's just one piece of it.
If we're being encouraged to consider all of these things, I don't think we need to limit it with that word, because as I hear what you're saying, I also understand that it would be nice to be able to cover that with sales tax, but we've been talking about comparing apples apples to apples and oranges to oranges this whole time. And I don't see that as being something that we want to hold ourselves to. And I think if we put that word in there, it's going to encourage that to continue. And so by using that as more of a guidance, you know, for how we do this, to consider these forms of revenue, taxes being one of them, I feel like I would be more inclined to what Brian is suggesting as well.
So, and I think in number two, the word tax burden, until we can define it, I'm reluctant to put something in if we don't know what the definition of tax burden is. And so can you, I don't understand what it is referring to.
I would suggest that we, perhaps we you know, download and bring the report, and so we can talk about it on next week. We're talking about various reports and documents that we would have available to us to make this type of decision. That's just, it's one document that talks about the tax burden based on, you know, like property taxes, you know, what are the sources of revenues in communities. I'd like it to be as comparable to rural communities as possible, to, you know, and not, or, you know, like Mike was saying, not be comparing, you know, our income and our revenue sources, you know, with other larger municipalities.
I'm still concerned on this word tax burden in terms of myself reading it after having been in on this discussion, as well as, you know, other community members reading it. I can't imagine we're going to go look. I guess it just needs, if we're using language, I think it should be language that we all understand, or at least is defined as to what it is. So factors such as community tax burden, I still would like to have a definition of what that is.
I'll bring it with me on Monday. We'll talk about it again on Monday.
How this would work is if we're comparing, I guess, say via the AML tables or something, position to another similar position in a different community, and if that community had a much higher tax burden than we do, then we would discount the need to increase the pay accordingly. In other words, the person doesn't have to pay as high a taxes here as they do there, so we don't have to pay them as much. Is that how this gets applied? It's not like I'm trying to be argumentative. I'm just trying to understand how it would actually function, how it would operate.
Let me bring it next week.
I'd be fine with starting with this version rather than the one that I put forth. And then if we want to adjust it in the meeting, we can do that. Does that sound good? Is that the plan? Okay, and thank you guys for giving it as much thought as you did. I'm sorry I didn't give it a little more.
Mr. Mayor, may I? So, Shelley, are you going to provide me with an updated version of this before Wednesday 10 a.m., or would you like me to use this one?
Because, well, you probably don't want it, you know, to have a yellow footer with our informal.
Right. I would like as much of a final copy by no later than 10 a.m. on Wednesday as possible, because that's what everybody will be voting on.
Right. So what I'll do is I'll take out the footers. I won't make any other changes. And then we'll talk about, you know, these two paragraphs, 2 and 6, on Monday.
Okay, and I guess just as a reminder to the other council members, it sounds like, you know, there might be some amendments or whatever happening, and I do require those in writing. Just good. So you know in advance.
Yeah, they can be written up in advance.
Yeah, that's not by Wednesday, is it? Yeah, yep.
One reason why I give you suggested motions, because I have to put exactly how you say it into the minutes. And so if you change? Would I, and then I'm able to prep them in advance, and whatever changes need to happen can happen a lot smoother during the actual meeting, because everything comes to a head right when we switch agenda items. So, you know, if you guys make up your own motions, that's fine, but it's super helpful for me to have them in writing. It's just more of a clerical thing for me.
Yeah, yeah, I'll get a written motion to you for clarity's sake, and then I'll read it exactly the way I wrote it.
Yeah. Okay, so, well, good. I like the progress on that. Thank you. And I think it'll be helpful to, you know, however this finally comes out, it's going to be helpful in the future. So that takes us through the agenda. And the only other thing I wanted to mention.
So the resolution says of Gustavus policy and procedure for annual review and adjustments of salaries and wages. So we've only just talked about the adjustment of salaries and wages. Is there any looking at the procedure for the annual review?
That's covered in an existing policy and procedure in quite detail. And it's a pretty good system. So we have a policy and procedure for annual review of our employees, and we've been using it, following it pretty well every year.
Yeah, I had read that as annual review and adjustment of salaries and wages, not the annual review separate from.
Yeah, you're right there.
But I can see how that could be.
Because I looked at the annual review.
Okay.
And I wrote to you one suggestion on an annual review, and most of the places that I've worked, I have had an opportunity to write a review in an annual review of my supervisor. And in looking at the policy, everything is like top down, where it says the supervisor writes the review of the employee. And I was suggested in the letter I wrote to you that we include something that gives at least an opportunity for the people who are working under people to make some type of a comment or review. And that it's because I think that as we talk about how important it is to maintain our employees, and I think communication all the way around is one way to maintain not only the, you know, the supervisors, but the employees as well, that I think are just as a part of important part of the chain, and that the communication both ways. And so when I read this about annual review, I thought I went back and looked at what was in the annual review. And that was just one thing I thought could be, potentially be added.
Yeah.
And to add it so that each person, employee, had an opportunity to write some type of a feedback or be asked for that in some venue about their supervisors.
Yeah, they sort of can, but it's not explicit. And I think that's a good idea. You could propose an amendment to the policy and procedure for the annual review to provide for an opportunity for employees to submit a review of their supervision.
Yeah, I'd vote for that.
And so does that go within here, or how does that?
It would go in, it would be an edit to the annual review policy and procedure.
Because this is what we're putting out here. Is this going to replace something that's already
This is new. And this just deals with salaries, thinking about salaries with regard to the annual operating budget, because that's when we adjust. Karen, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's called a performance evaluation in our policy and procedure, right. Janine. Uh-huh. And it's, you know, easy to make changes to policy and procedure. It requires a resolution, just like what we're doing for this current thing, but this is a different policy and procedure. So what you're suggesting would need to be a new resolution and a new, you know, updated policy, just changing those things that you're talking about.
Okay. And so, thank you.
So have at it. Okay. The other thing I wanted to mention was that Kathy and I had the pleasure of a visit from Ralph Watkins, the superintendent of the school district, today. And we had a very nice discussion with him. Talked about how, we have been developing a proposal for them for an MOU to kind of make better, set up a better relationship between the school and the city, and particularly with regard to the use of the library, and so the library can be a more useful asset to the school, but still, of course, remain its primary role as a public library. So we felt that it's been underused in recent years, and that there are opportunities to improve that relationship. And Ralph's very positive on that. We're going to continue to work with him. He asked us to work it out and send it to him first. So that's what we'll do. But tomorrow night, he is holding a roundtable at the school starts at 5 p.m. With a spaghetti feed, and they're providing the spaghetti. Ralph's cooking it up, I guess. He says he cooks a mean spaghetti. So, Kathy and I are going to go, and it's an opportunity for the school to have some outreach to the community and bring people in to discuss things in the school. Ralph will give an update first on some things that they're doing, particularly focusing around the new strategic plan and their vision and kinds of things they're moving forward with as a district. And then they'll have an I think he mentioned the Alaska Reads Act, which I'm not familiar with, but that's one thing he's going to be discussing, and opportunities for it. And then there'll be plenty of time for Q&A comments and so forth. So I would encourage any members of the community with an interest in how we relate to the school to join us at that roundtable tomorrow night at the school. And I wish some of the folks that are, have found it necessary to move to Juneau or something, for the school opportunities could be here too, but at least people who are here in the community right now can, it's an opportunity to understand better what they're doing at the school and maybe express some things that they would like to see the school doing with regard to its relationships with the community. So I encourage anybody with some time to try to fit it in tomorrow night, 5 o'clock. I have the time right. I think he did say 5, didn't he? I wrote down on this pad.
He said
start there. Yeah. Okay. Right. So
your mic's off. Your mic's off.
Yes. 5 o'clock. They're going to start at 5:30. And just for everybody's reminder, Karen did send out that Alaska taxable report from 2021 on the 7th. Of March, when we were first bringing it up, it was a link to what you were talking about. So if you guys want to look at what it really is, you can find it on your email from Karen of 37. Okay. And there's several tables in there, and the one in question is the per capita tax revenues. So
yeah,
I just wanted to say, when you study it and reminder, read what it's right. about, there, it that's where out, it right. is. So, okay.
Anybody else have anything they wanted to discuss? Oh, Madam Clerk.
There was one more thing on the agenda that I wanted to mention. It's going to get pulled off. It's not quite ready, and it'll be on the May agenda. But Paul, when I redid the records destruction schedule, this was before a lot of you were on the council, it was last year, I updated our records retention schedule because it needed to be. It was missing a lot of things. And one of the things that it was missing that I didn't put in there was a destruction schedule for the DRC. because Paul wasn't quite ready for that yet, and he wasn't ready to destroy anything, but he is now, and he's creating it, you know, based on what his records are there at the DRC. And so he's not quite ready for that, but he will be ready for it in May. So that you'll see that agenda item again in May.
Anybody else? I've been going for close to 3 hours, so looks like we're done for our work session then tonight. So thanks everybody for sticking with it and thinking about all these items, and particularly for the attention on the PFAS presentation. I think that was particularly valuable to us. So, okay, well, thank you all, and good night then.
Good night.